This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. First Financial Tax and Accounting Services provides signature support for our program. Matt Doyle is producing today, and our special guest is Field and King Alexander, the gentleman who led Louisiana State University as president and chancellor for 7 years, 2013 to 2020. He also has been the president at three other places in academia, at Cal State University in Long Beach, where he was prior to taking the LSU post, at Murray State University, where he succeeded his father as president, and at Oregon State University, which was a short tenure that ended with his resignation 6 weeks ago. And for anybody who's alive in Baton Rouge and probably beyond, the King Alexander name is now a household name. It already was well known, but based on events of the last several weeks that have been unearthed by reporters and also King Alexander and others who are talking about it, he is now in the news more so than ever, and it has been a difficult time for him and many other people, and he paid with his job at Corvallis, Oregon. We're going to talk about him and his legacy and where LSU goes from here. He still has ties to the old war school, and his legacy at LSU is immense. So if you'd like to join the conversation as we move along, we'll likely take some calls, 877-217-5757, and talk at talklouisiana.org. And good morning to you, President Alexander.
Hello, Jim. How are you?
Doing well. How have the last 6 weeks been for you?
Well, it's been kind of a whirlwind. Certainly, there's been a lot of misinformation in the arena, and I just look forward to sharing more and more information about the facts of what we did do with regard to Title IX and establishing the Title IX office and the hundreds of Title IX investigations that subsequently followed, and the educational process of getting our campus, as well as the many other campuses and the other chancellors, to take this issue seriously on every campus, whether it's the medical schools, even the safety net hospitals. This was an education process, and so there's just a lot of misinformation in the arena that I just certainly like to get some facts on the table. So okay. I thank you for allowing me to be here.
Well, and we appreciate you doing this, because as we have found that many people in your situation would not, and it is good that you're a transparent guy, and here he is. And amid all this other commotion in his life, his mother died a few days ago, so King Alexander is joining us from Gainesville, Florida. And for those unfamiliar with his mother, and one of the great ironies of all this news over the last few months is that his mother, Ruth, was a legend at the University of Florida for Title IX, of all things. Tell us that story before we go anywhere else.
Well, my mother started the Lady Gator Athletic Program, but more importantly, she testified to Congress in 1970 and 71 to get Title IX established. So I'm very familiar with what Title IX has, how it has been transformed over the years. And in fact, I told my chancellors it was on the agenda of every one of our chancellors' meetings. And Tom Skinner, our former general counsel, told me over and over again that I'm badgering him too much about Title IX issues. And he was being sarcastic, but it just shows that this was certainly one of the top priorities in my administration. And we can get into some of the details a little bit later.
And your mother, Ruth, who died a few days ago, was a legend. And I'm not using that word lightly, at the University of Florida. Why?
Well, she was the founder of Lady Gator Athletics and hired the first women's coaches in 1971 and 72. And that was against a lot of scrutiny, a great deal of scrutiny, when nobody wanted women playing sports. And that includes Bear Bryant, who told her that nobody will ever watch a woman play a sporting event. And so she took on some tough fights, and I'm just very proud to carry on her legacy, certainly in women's sports. And I have three daughters, and my three daughters were true beneficiaries as they played sports in high school. And I know many of the opportunities that exist today were because of women like her in the 70s.
King Alexander was a college athlete, played men's basketball at St. Lawrence University, where he received his bachelor's degree. Masters of Science from the University of Oxford, and a PhD in Higher Education Administration from the University of Wisconsin. And as mentioned, prior to arriving at LSU, official first date was July 1, 2013. He had been president of Murray State University in Kentucky, where he was born, and at Cal State University, Long Beach. Now, that was a prestigious job. Why did you seek the LSU post?
Well, LSU is a prestigious job, and it was an opportunity. We were doing something remarkable by putting the presidency or the system office in the university together. It was a first ever for our institution, for LSU, and it was an opportunity to get back to the South, closer to my mother, who was ailing, and family members who were certainly in different parts of the Southeast. And the time was right, judging by sort of the political waves and the political dynamics of California.
Well, you were sailing along, and I got mostly good reviews for your performance amid numerous budget cuts, I think 15 or 16 in your 7 years, mostly all in the Jindal years, but LSU was the beneficiary of some really bad stuff during those times, and King Alexander kept the wheels together, and there were projects that continued, more than $1 billion worth of projects that happened on his watch, and as I stated, most people were saying, rah, rah, go King, and then you hit a speed bump with this holistic admissions approach. Do you have any regrets?
Oh, not at all. In fact, now I can actually say what I was thinking regarding holistic. LSU was one of the last to adopt holistic admissions. And first and foremost, this is an issue about race. And the poor children of the state, primarily African-American students, Hispanic students, being denied and withheld their right to access to the state's flagship public university. And this created a firestorm of opposition from the Board of Regents and those who had for decades carved out an unfair advantage for wealthy, primarily wealthy white families and private schools that use the standardized test score to give their students an advantage through preparatory tests, through tutoring. And I have to quote Tony Carnevale from the Georgetown Center of Education and Workforce. He said, the more you rely on the test score, the richer and whiter the university becomes. And he even went on to say, the use of test scores as arbitrary qualifications for entry into good colleges has truly made a mockery of educational opportunity. And it has, and I think the country is now moving towards even test optional. But this issue was grounded in racism, the fact that we would allow 4% exceptions, and these are from the people who didn't want exceptions, they would allow 4%. A disproportionate amount of that 4% went to athletics. And as a percentage of the entering athletic class, it's about 26% were exceptions. As a percentage of the freshman class that weren't athletes, it was about 5 to 6%. So clearly that 4% threshold was to allow students of color to play football and basketball for LSU, but not to allow qualified that lower income students of color who were not athletes to participate in the classroom and in the laboratories. It is first and foremost, this is a racist issue, and it is showing in the numbers that have been admitted that would not have normally have been admitted. And by chasing selectivity, they have reduced educational opportunity for decades. And this was truly a wealthy advantage over those disadvantaged students that were in rural areas and also in urban areas. So it was by far the right thing to do. I was just surprised we would have such resistance from the Board of Regents and others. But now I realize it was because we were leveling the playing field for disadvantaged students who needed LSU more than any other students need great faculty and a great flagship university.
Well, there are people alive and in powerful positions in our city and in our state and in this country who were part of an LSU that was all white. Now, are you saying that some of those people would like to return to those kinds of days?
I'm saying this was a battle between old LSU and the new LSU that it could be. And the new LSU looks more like the state of Louisiana and the rest of the country, if indeed it's allowed to continue taking a closer look at these students. And I'll give you a couple examples. One student was a valedictorian at our high school, but her test score was 1 or 2 points below the minimum average that prohibited her from attending LSU. Well, as it turns out, she was homeless as well. And I would put all my marbles with that individual, because I know she's going to succeed, and we should give her every chance possible. There are countless examples of those students by using holistic admissions. We gave them a chance to succeed at LSU.
877-217-5757 is your Talk Louisiana number. F. King Alexander is with us for some more time, and we will return in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana, and our special guest is former LSU President and Chancellor F. King Alexander. He logged 7 years at the Old War School, and by today's standards, that's a long tenure. As one of his predecessors as Chancellor, Mike Martin, has stated on this show, LSU is the most political place on the planet, and King Alexander was discussing some of the political aspects of his decision to go to a holistic admissions standard. And during the break, I got some emails about it. One is a good question from a listener asking, what happened to the young woman you just mentioned who was homeless, president of her high school class, and did not get the requisite score on the ACT to get into LSU? What happened to her?
Well, that's a good question. Jose Aviles, who is the vice president of enrollment management, would know, because Jose tracks a lot of these students. And she was one example of many, many students that we allowed to, in fact, the entering classes didn't decline in their test scores as an average. And I found it interesting that the commentary around this issue is that, quote, we were dumbing down the university, number one, or we were reducing our standards, which if you think about sort of the racist overtones of that, by becoming more diverse, we had to have been dumbing down our standards. That wasn't the case whatsoever. And in fact, many of these students that we have allowed to attend because we've taken a closer look at their portfolio. That's what holistic means, is that we're not going to simply measure you by two numbers. That we're going to see where you come from. We're going to see what neighborhoods you've overcome, what school systems you've been able to overcome, whether you've helped raise your siblings because you've had a single parent family. All of those things get factored into this quote holistic approach. So we also did zero in on these students to help give them the necessary support that allows them to succeed. So I hope she's progressing towards graduation. I haven't been there in a year and a half, but Jose Aviles would probably know better than I would about this individual student.
All right. Well, I've obviously talked to others in addition to President Alexander and at that time, and there were those who said that you were on the right track, but based on some of the things you just said, LSU had to get ready for this, and you didn't finesse it that well. Could you have done that better?
Well, in fact, we paid closer attention. We ran statistical analysis on the most at-risk 1,000 entering, about 1,000 entering freshmen. And we paid particular, at least when I was there, we zeroed in on the 1,000 most at-risk students to make sure that they have the support network available and that we're monitoring, tracking, and even right down to the RAs, knocking on their doors to see if they're going to class and making sure they're keeping up. So we zeroed in on the roughly about 1,000 most at-risk students to make sure they succeed. And what I can say is that each and every year while I was at LSU, not just the entering class became more diverse, but the graduating class set records of African-American graduates, Hispanic graduates, first-generation Pell graduates, veteran graduates, you name it, the records kept getting broken at graduation, which is really where it matters the most.
Does that include overall graduates as well as far as actual numbers?
Jim, that includes overall graduates, total number of graduates as well. Okay. And so each year we set records on virtually every category of students at graduation.
Well, diversity has been one of your passions, and that is a sensitive issue here and everywhere in this country, unfortunately. But the fraternity system at LSU and the sorority system, they're largely segregated. And the fraternities, as we know, have misbehaved, and you shut down a number of them. How many fraternities did you shut down, and what cost did that have in the overall goodwill you had with powerful people at LSU and in the city and state?
So, Jim, that's a very good question, and I'll point out, because I know that the chairman of the board has made a statement that we simply shut down the fraternities because of the Max Gruber hazing death. That was the straw that broke the camel's back, because prior to the hazing incident, as well as Penn State and Florida State that had similar circumstances and incidents, that for about 2.5 years, the national dialogue, primarily with fraternities, was about putting drugs in drinks. It was about sexual assault going on in fraternity houses. And that was a 2-year dialogue, national dialogue. So prior to the Max Gruber event, we averaged probably about 25% to 30% of our fraternities were either suspended or on probation, either due to an assault issue or due to drug use, illegal drug use, or due to hazing incidents, such as the one, unfortunately, ended Max Gruber's life as a student. So this is a combination of misbehavior that the fraternity system and the Greek system just felt immune from understanding. They didn't accept the education of sexual assault very well, and they went forward in just continuing to hide things, and it got to a tipping point where we had to shut down all, and I'll point out, because most people I've said this, all social activities of the Greek system. They could still meet on Sunday night and do philanthropic events, but all social activities were shut down, and they were shut down the year that my daughter was a senior in one of the sororities there, and she was in leadership. So I took a beating at home as well for doing this, but it was necessary to re-educate the Greek system and Greek leaders and all the Greek members that we're taking these issues seriously. And this is the fact that we shut it down received national attention because.
You still there?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Well, I was not a member of the Greek system when I was there, but I'm fully aware that those who were often do better than others. And part of it is networking, and they have positive experiences for the most part of their time as members of fraternities and sororities. They believe that helped them immensely. They made friends for lives. It made the campus experience much more rewarding for them. But it is largely an all-white system, or by necessity an all-black sorority or fraternity, because they can't get into the others. How do you bridge the gap between all the good things that happen from the Greek system or any president at LSU and the obvious issues that are relevant, particularly in these times?
Well, first of all, we appreciate all the great things the Greek system does. And in fact, in student government, disproportionately was many Greek leaders that disproportionately ran our student government. The philanthropic things that they do. There's so many good things that they do. We didn't have an anti-Greek approach to this. We had an anti-hazing, anti-illegal drug, and anti-sexual assault approach to this. And weeding those bad behaviors out was indeed an important goal.
Jorla in North Baton Rouge, we'll start with you. We have some folks who'd like to talk with King Alexander, and Jorla is first up. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Fine. What's your question, Joel?
Well, I am. My question. Let me preface my question by saying that I'm a proud graduate of LSU of the PhD in physics, and that I had to call this morning to express my appreciation to King Alexander for the brave and work he did when the Jindal administration was assailing higher education. He defended not only LSU, but all the other systems that I know, that's one. Number two, his position about holistic admission is something I know from a pure scientific point of view, and it is backed, among other things, by the most stable of the law of cognitive science known as the power law of human performance. Those who want to know, learn more about it, you have my number, can contact me.
All right. Well, you've got some people on your side, and I think you know that, and there are others who believe that it was good riddance when you left. And that's part of the job. You've been in four universities. You know you can't please everybody, but is there anything you would have done differently over the 7 years you were at LSU?
I think the great disappointment was that we were trying to manage an institution that was going through the worst budget cuts of any state in the United States. 16 budget cuts in 8 years. And in fact, the year we created the Title IX office under Tom Skinner's leadership, who did a great job in investigating everything the Title IX office heard about, we had to find money while we were also, if you remember, trying to figure out how to plan for financial exigency.
All right, we're going to spend some more time with King Alexander. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. We're halfway through the hour, and we will talk with King Alexander, the former president and chancellor at LSU, about the scandal that has enveloped the university. It's gained national attention, and some of these things happened when he was president, and he is here to talk about his actions. But I did want you to finish your response to the question about what you would have done differently, and you were going into the budget cuts that you endured. Is there something that you would have done differently to react to those cuts?
No, it was unfortunate that we couldn't persuade, and I'm disappointed that we couldn't persuade legislators, state legislators, to actually care more about the next generation of students. And that is clearly evidenced by the per student drop. I think that Louisiana is down to about $3,700 per student FTE, and the national average is about $6,500. This was an abandonment on the part of the state legislature and the government of really the next generation of students and children. And I'm disappointed I couldn't have done more that could have stymied that decline, as well as help put more resources in to allow the next generation of students to have better educational opportunities than they currently have.
A couple of years ago, just over 2 years ago, you were, this would have been 2019, 6 years into the job. You're summoned to meet, I think, on a Monday night at Chubin's, a nice restaurant on Perkins Road, unfortunately closed during the pandemic, with four LSU board members. What happened that night?
Well, I can tell you what happened that night. I kind of call it the Monday night massacre. It's so vivid to me. It was April 15th on a Monday night. I got summoned Monday morning to come to Jubin's at 7 or 7:30. When I got there, you had board leadership and current as well as future board leadership and previous board leadership that basically told me that they had hired a new athletics director without our knowledge or any of my vice president's knowledge, and I needed to fire Joe Oliva the next morning. They handed this new salary that had been negotiated on a cocktail napkin to me. Apparently, this is not the first time that these secret meetings have gone on, because when I started it at LSU back in 2013, there have been a series of secret meetings that made a determination on the future of Les Miles. And I walked in, and they gave me the verdict of a decision that had been made 3 months prior while I was handing out diplomas at Cal State Long Beach. So I don't know if this is a habit of the board, but the one at Jubin's was particularly notable, because it basically violates university policy, accreditation standards, to have a small number of board members without the rest of the board knowing that they had worked out a deal, no telling for how long and for how much money, which was substantially more than what we were paying Joe Oliva as well as the associate ADs at the time that were part of the package. It was quite shocking. I'd never experienced anything like it in 20 years as a public university president. And if people want to understand what this means, is I've never been summoned to the back of Jubin's to replace a dean or a vice president of academic affairs. But to replace the athletics director without anybody on my staff, myself, knowing it, is quite an extraordinary story, but also quite an extraordinary intrusion into university governance and shared governance as well.
Was this a response to the suspension of Will Wade?
I think the Will Wade, and I give credit to Joe, and the decisions we made with Will Wade were exactly accurate. He'd been picked up on an FBI wiretap. There were 19 other calls that we didn't know about that we wanted information about that he refused to give us information about. And we suspended him, and I think it was used as an opportunity to remove Joe Oliva. And at that meeting, I said, Joe's contract's up at the end of the year. Can we just, he's done a good job in so many areas. Can we give him a graceful fall from this and a retirement? And the decision had already been made to replace Joe Oliva. This is the salary. And I had to get with Tom Skinner, my general counsel, and meet with Joe Oliva the very next morning and tell Joe that he's been fired by, not necessarily by me, because I wasn't part of these secret discussions and meetings, but by the board leadership.
Well, Joe, at one point, as we know, recommended the firing of Les Miles. Now, he was the AD. Presumably, he was his boss. Who's in charge? Like, if a football coach is on the ropes for any number of reasons, personal or losing games, does the AD fire the coach? Does the president fire the coach? Does the board fire the coach? Does the governor fire the coach? Who's in charge?
Well, in high-profile athletic decisions, coaching decisions, certainly you would want members of your board, your chairman, your head of the athletics committee involved. But Joe actually sent that to me before I started at I was still at Cal State Long Beach. I wasn't sure how I was going to fire Les Miles from Cal State Long Beach, but I also didn't know the circumstances. Joe had been privy, as well as Bill Jenkins. Bill Jenkins was the president. Apparently, there were 6 months of quiet, secret meetings with board leadership about this issue. And Joe had been privy to every one of those meetings. I had not been at all. I found out about the investigation in early June. I didn't have any details. I still don't know how many meetings they had or how long the duration of that conversation went throughout the spring and winter. And so Joe was privy to the decision that was made May 15th to keep Les Miles, but put him on some sort of probation. That was when the decision was made, and the decision, I was just updated about the decision July 2nd, and there's no way that a new president is going to come in and with the board leadership, as well as with the general counsel saying there's not enough evidence to remove him, everybody in the room saying, with the exception of Joe, saying you ought to go against your board and you ought to go against your general counsel and do something different. That's just impossible for a president on their second day on the job. So I think Joe's message to me was just to cover himself, and that he may have disagreed with what the board decided.
All right. Well,
Bill Jenkins was president.
Yeah, he was president on his way out the door, and probably didn't want to handle this because his football coach is the most powerful person in the state of Louisiana. That's unfortunate, but quite often that's true. But Les Miles twisted in the wind for a few years, and then ultimately you did fire him after he lost a football game. Some are saying, look, why didn't you fire him long before he lost to Auburn at the buzzer in 2016?
Well, because he was on probation, and if he had violated that probation in any shape or form, that would have been grounds to go forward. He didn't violate the probation that we were aware of, our general counsel and others. However, with being on probation, anybody on probation is a risk to the university. So the opportunity rose at the time. The board agreed. The board leadership has to agree on a decision of that magnitude. Now, with regard to other decisions, we removed people, faculty members and others, that we also had to seek board approval on. Teresa Buchanan, that went all the way to the Fifth Circuit, where the Faculty Senate censored me because I was enforcing Title IX, and she was removed because of recurring Title IX violations. We have numerous cases of that with a number of faculty members, a number of administrators, a number of doctors at medical schools that were removed because of Title IX violations. And the fact that we were enforcing Title IX everywhere that we could, that we could investigate, that we knew about.
Now, in Miles' case, we now have a high-ranking official at the athletic department who's suing the university, who's still employed there, who says that he wanted, and I'm quoting her, blondes with big breasts and nothing but those types of people in his office, and that he was an abusive person as far as sexual misconduct. Did you know about any of that?
I knew about limited details, very limited details that I was informed of when I first arrived, and why the May 15th decision was made from Bill Jenkins, and why it was made from the board leadership as well as the athletic committee leadership who was there. And I was aware of not everything that I have heard since, but I did know he was on probation for some very creepy behavior.
But not creepy enough to dismiss him, according to all these people, including Taylor Porter, who did not recommend his firing. Is that correct?
Taylor Porter and Shelby McKenzie recommended there is not enough evidence to recommend firing. And you have to listen to your general counsel.
Well, that would be true of board members as well, wouldn't it?
Exactly, Jim. That's exactly right.
So did Taylor Porter mess up?
You know, I wasn't there. You know, I don't know the details of what went on in those meetings 6 months prior to me arriving. In fact, more of the details are coming out, I think, in Sports Illustrated or even in the Hush Blackwell report. More of the details came out that I was even unaware of with regard to those meetings that went on. It could have been 6 to 8 months prior to me even arriving in Louisiana.
What's your impression? We're going to a break in 30 seconds, but your Cliff Notes version of the Hush Blackwell report.
I think the Hush Blackwell report identified about 8 cases, and they could have identified and gone into many other Title IX cases that we had, and they just repeated. Every one of those cases were investigated. A couple of them, athletics didn't tell us in a timely manner, but the second our Title IX office heard about it, we went into full investigative mode, and our police were involved. So what the HB report shows is that our police were involved, these were investigated, and Drake Davis went to prison, went to jail because we enforced it.
We'll be back after this timeout. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana, and former LSU President and Chancellor F. King Alexander is with us for our final segment. He's been with us for the full hour, and graciously so, and he has a story to tell that will continue long after our discussion today. But as we were going to the break, we were talking about the Hush Blackwell report. You were giving your take on the findings and saying in some ways it exonerates you and others at LSU. But did you participate at all in the report?
So at the very end of the report, Hush Blackwell called. And I know that Tom Skinner, I was hoping they would interview, who is the general counsel in charge of Title IX, which was he was never interviewed. I was wondering if they were going to call, and they did. And I asked if you would just please submit your questions, because I had no idea that they were going all the way back to Les Miles and why I didn't fire Les Miles. I mean, I wasn't even there. And so they submitted the questions, 13 questions. I answered those questions, returned the questions to them, but none of the answers ended up in the report, because I do believe I had heard that a draft of the report had already been created prior to my submission of my 13 questions. So I wish they had contacted me sooner so the answers to those questions could have found their way into the report. But I will say the report shows no deliberate indifference. Sharon Lewis' lawsuit shows no deliberate indifference. It does show that there was a breakdown in athletics and reporting, and that breakdown should not have occurred because of all the amount of educational programming we gave to athletics was more about Title IX than anywhere else. And I'll just give a case in point. We were the first SEC school, along with the University of Tennessee, to require every student athlete to go through Title IX sexual assault misconduct training every summer and make them sign off that they've had the training. That was 2 years before the NCAA implemented a similar program. May have been copying the program that Tennessee and we put in place, not just for staff and coaches that was in place, but for every single student athlete. So if you take a look at the Blackwell report, it shows that there was a breakdown in the athletic ranks, but we didn't have similar breakdowns in our med schools, on our other three regional campuses. Reports went through, mm-hmm. people were removed, investigations occurred.
It's a murky situation in some cases, and of course people's memories fade over time, but some of these are things you just wouldn't forget, like the meeting at Jubin's, and you have told things that were not in the report that are certainly relevant to what is going on. But the Hush Blackwell report has been used both for you and against you, and you're saying that it largely exonerates you. The Darius Geis situation, how much did you know about that, President Alexander?
So I knew Darius. I generally check on about five or six at-risk kids. Darius was always an at-risk because of his neighborhood, his family circumstances. I got to know Darius. I would check in with him about four times a year just to see how he's doing. But I also checked in with the head of the NAACP. I was also the faculty advisor for the student NAACP. I was part of the 100 Black Men of Baton Rouge, which is a wonderful organization that we mentor young at-risk students to keep them on track in high school and helping them go to college. So Darius was one of many that I checked in on. I knew nothing about Darius's any of the instances. If I had heard that Darius was involved in any of those things on campus, I would have certainly removed myself from interacting with Darius. I was simply doing what I did with the 100 Black Men in Long Beach, California, and 100 Black Men in Baton Rouge, which was trying to nurture very at-risk students, as well as many others that we thought, and they're primarily African-American males, to help them succeed in college when all the odds were against them. So, but none, my wife nor I knew of anything Darius had done illegal or against any university policies. If we had heard about that, we would have completely distanced ourselves from Darius. The first I heard about Darius's problems was when he was playing at Washington, and then those incidents occurred.
Well, I guess you're saying you didn't know anything about the Gloria Scott incident at the Superdome and others, and of course Darius is also accused of sexual assault. Do you think LSU kept this information from you?
Well, I did. It was reported to us on the Scott issue at a football game, and we did look into it. But you'd have to talk to our Title IX office. We had heard about that, and normally I don't hear about these things because our Title IX office gets these complaints. And this was an outside complaint that went to, I think, directly to the athletics department that then responded to our Title IX office. Is best I can recollect. I don't know the how it got from an outside source to athletics and athletics to Title IX, but I do think there's a path there somewhere that referenced it. And if our Title IX heard about it, I'm sure they looked into it. I mean, they investigated every claim that was made, and that Tom Skinner will be the first to tell you that exactly was their job, and Jenny Stewart as well.
All right, now. Les Miles was almost fired at the end of 2015 before he was fired in 16, and presumably Jimbo Fisher was going to come to LSU. What happened to change that?
Well, once again, it was a very high-level discussion. The discussion about Les, well, and there was no indication he hadn't violated his probation, so it had nothing to do with the limited sort of probation he was on after he went through counseling and other things. But it was a discussion at the various high level. It involved board leadership, and the board leadership, the athletic director, and I agreed that if Les changes some of the things that he's doing, maybe this next year it could work. And it just in a combination of things, A, he was... He, I was worried a bit because he's still an at-risk individual, but there wasn't enough pressure to remove him at the time, in addition to the fact that I always thought that he was at risk because he was a risk to the university simply because he was on this various kind of probation where you have to leave your door open, and in fact, the whole athletic department went through a similar, because of Les Miles, the entire athletic department was required not to use student athletes for personal, running personal errands, groceries, coming over and babysitting, all these things was mandated throughout the athletics department that no coach can take advantage of student workers by making them do personal things for them.
Did you ever talk to him directly about these matters?
I never talked to Les directly about these matters. Those matters, Joe Oliva, he worked for Joe Oliva. I know Joe Oliva talked to him directly about these matters. Most likely that would have involved human resources as well. Mm-hmm.
Did Governor Jindal know about this?
I do not know if Governor Jindal knew about any of this. And, you know, once again, most of that information was disseminated 6 months prior to me getting there. And I still don't know the full extent of the conversations that went on prior to me arriving at LSU.
Well, as I mentioned, in your tenure, despite the budget cuts, if you look at Nicholson Drive, you'll see the legacy from a more bricks and mortar standpoint of King Alexander's tenure. You also won a Nobel Prize, but most of the attention in the last decade has been on 2019 and and the 15-0 football team of Coach Ed Orgeron. Is that necessarily a bad thing, or do we neglect the positives that did occur under your watch?
Well, I would say that the most important thing that occurred was the fact that we broke every graduation record of every student group, especially the neediest student populations. And that's what I'm most proud of. I will say that I wish we had, particularly among many of our newer board leadership, a greater attention on the things that I think that mattered academically. I do remember a meeting which was shocking to me in a conference room in the back of the university administration building when the incoming board chair slammed his hand down on the table and said that our state appropriations, when we're talking about state appropriations, enrollment, and all the things that mattered, he said all these things will take care of themselves if we win a national championship. And I looked at Dan Lysel, our financial vice president, and said, I can't believe this was just said in a room full of people.
Are you bitter?
I'm not bitter. I think the accomplishments that we had a good team. We made it work. Our administration was small. We were 20% below in administrative spending per student. And we made it work, and despite the worst budget cuts in the United States, we still improved our diversity, our enrollment, and our graduating numbers, and succeeded for thousands more students than would have succeeded if we hadn't focused entirely on graduating our students and giving them a better life.
We're short on time, but some are saying that you're radioactive. Can you get a job in higher education now, or do you want one?
Oh, I'm going to keep fighting for students. I mean, that's my life business, and I'm going to continue fighting for the next generation of students. And I tell you one thing, I've fought 20 different years in state legislatures, and I've had 5 successful ones and 15 ones that have been cuts. That should tell everybody that the problem is not with our students. The problem is with our state legislatures that are turning their backs on the next generation of students who will drive the next economy if they get invested in.
Well, thank you, President Alexander. It's been a pleasure. And First Financial Tax and Accounting Services provides signature support.